Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Gungaloo Country in Queensland. Before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community.
The Lentil Intervention is an Australasian educational and advocacy platform dedicated to raising awareness about the current climate and health crises.
And on this podcast, we invite guests to chat to you about topics that will inspire you to take action to improve your own health and the health of the planet.
So please subscribe to and share this podcast and visit our website for the full show notes.
And don't forget to buy us a coffee if you'd like to support our work.
We're recording this on the eve of Matariki, although by the time you listen to this episode, it's already the following week. Matariki is the Māori New Year, and according to Te Ao Māori, it is an important period of the year to consider one's well-being and that of whānau, family, as well as the health of our taiao, natural environment, and Papatuanuku, our earth mother. So whilst there are a number of things you can do, having a plant-powered feast and doing something meaningful for the environment are encouraged to celebrate Matariki. It also means that this conversation we're about to have is quite timely.
Perfect timing, yes. So today we're sitting down for a chat with Dr. Peter Johnston, an accredited practicing dietitian with a PhD in human genetics, who's at the forefront of the plant-based nutrition space in Australia. So Peter is also a fellow of the Australasian Society of Lifestyle Medicine and has recently launched a new business, Melbourne Lifestyle Medicine, along with two of our previous guests, Jenny Cameron and Dr. Malcolm Mackay. So they're very busy helping people transform their health, but they're also training up a new generation of health professionals to understand the personal and planetary health benefits of healthy nutrition and lifestyle practices. So Peter, it's a treat to get to talk to you today. I know we've been wanting to make this happen for quite a while. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure and a privilege. And I know I did handball an earlier opportunity off to Malcolm and Jenny, so we finally got around to it.
That's all right. That was season two, episode 34, for those wanting to go back to that interview. But we're in season three. That's what matters. Peter, again, thank you for coming onto the show. And let's start off with a fascinating background, I would say. We've had a number of health professionals on the show, and yours certainly stands out in terms of how you got to eventually being a plant-based nutrition expert. So let's start off with your background. Shearing gangs is what I read here. I won't tell more. I'll let you tell the story. Tell us a little bit about how it all started.
I grew up in New Zealand. I live in Melbourne, Australia now. I've lived in four countries and six or seven cities, which has been a real joy to see different parts of the world. But when I was a young lad in New Zealand in my latter years of high school, I managed to get work in shearing gangs through the summer holidays. And it was very hard work. We would work 5 a.m. to 5 p.m., 7 days a week, and a gang of seven of us plus a cook, and we would eat a sheep a day and every day. And my job as the wool presser was to cut up those sheep that were hanging in the shed. And sometimes they were a bit green, but the farmer would leave them hanging for a while because the meat got more tender and tasty from my memories. But yeah, I've come a long way because I haven't eaten meat or fish for 41 years now.
I was going to say, a bit different to what you're consuming now.
Very different.
Yeah. After that, though, you went one step further, really, and you've got a background working in a slaughterhouse as well. So, you know, you've seen firsthand how these animals are treated and processed, I suppose the PC word is for it. So what was your role there? What did you see there?
For my second degree in biochemistry and zoology and genetics, I was lucky to get a job with a biotech company for a couple of summers towards the end of that degree. And it was a valuable chance to learn some lab techniques and some mentoring with senior scientists. One of the things they were doing was making anti-tetanus vaccines for sheep, which required collecting vast volumes of sheep's blood from the killing chain. So once or twice a week, we'd go out to the local slaughterhouse and get geared up in all the white aprons and white clothing and white gumboots, on which blood shows up very clearly, and everyone gets covered in blood in these places. And we would collect 1,800 litres of fresh sheep's blood at a time. And we were there right on the killing chain where the sheep had their throats slit and were bleeding out, hanging by one foot, kicking around, urinating, unforgettable, you know, scarred into my brain. And you could smell the slaughterhouse before you even got close to it. The sound and the smell and the noise, it was like something out of hell, like a nightmare. And as you probably know, Paul McCartney once said, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everyone would be vegetarian. So that was unforgettable, really interesting, I guess, to see that and know what it's like on the inside, but not something I'd rush to do again. And I would love to see a day where that isn't done to animals. Interesting times, but the things we do for learning and the twists and turns where life takes you, I guess. I was already vegetarian at that point as well, not vegan. So I became vegetarian in 1981 through living with a vegetarian partner, and just picked it up out of habit after 12 months of living with her. I had no idea about the health, the environment, the ethics. I just didn't like meat suddenly a year in after living with her, and did begin to read then. So I read, you know, Francis Moore Lappe's classic work, Diet for a Small Planet, and other works like that. So I was starting to learn about the impacts gradually, but it wasn't my main focus at that point. It wasn't until a decade later when I moved to Canada for my postdoc at McGill University that I read Diet for a New America by John Robbins, which was a classic book that came out in 87. He was the heir to the Baskin-Robbins empire, and he walked away from those billions of dollars to live an ethical vegan life and share the knowledge around why people shouldn't eat animals. So that convinced me to go plant-based fully in 91 when I read it. So yeah, and here I am today, 31 years later, still fully plant-based and not regretting it. In fact, my only regret is I wish I'd been born and bred plant-based, which is what I hear from most vegans.
Now, well, you say that, and I wonder if your path might have been a bit different. You know, I mean, being vegetarian, even working in that kind of environment would have been quite traumatizing, perhaps. But before we carry on down that path, your studies, PhD in human genetics, that's very specific. And I believe you had quite a particular obsession as well at the time through those studies.
Still does.
Yes. And you could say a bit of a Peter Pan complex. I'm pretty obsessed with not aging, and I'm terrified of getting decrepit and old and dying. And I've read lots in this area, and my partner gave me a book on mortality and the history of the way humans try to avoid death and helping, you know, helping people come to terms with death. But the thought still terrifies me. So yeah, I, for some reason, during my first degree in psychology, a BA, I decided to go straight into the studying biological sciences to figure out what causes aging. At some point, there might have been a motorcycle accident when I was 18 and I nearly died and I broke my back. But for whatever reason, I got this obsession with not getting older and fear of losing my parents and the loved ones around me. So I was doing a lot of philosophy in that first degree as well. So that got me thinking a bit deeply and widely. But yeah, that led me all the way through to a PhD in human genetics, which I had a scholarship to do in Canberra at ANU. And that was really just learning the tools of the trade of how to clone and splice and sequence DNA. And then I contacted the three labs in the world that I could find were doing molecular genetic research on aging at the time for a postdoctoral fellowship, and all three offered me jobs. I took one in Montreal, which a kind of sliding doors moment. My life could have been quite different because it didn't work out well at all. They weren't very well equipped. They didn't have anyone doing recombinant DNA work. The boss was a bully. I got a bit disillusioned seeing senior academics lose their funding and lose their jobs. And they had mortgages and kids. So for various reasons, I walked away from that and meant to come back, but I didn't. I just, my life took a different direction. But I haven't lost the fear of death.
And it's also important to note that you're not someone to sit still. You're quite physically active. You partake in quite a few sports. Tell us a little bit about that, you know, part of the big picture about Dr. Peter Johnston.
I've skied all my life since I was seven. I feel increasingly guilty about it now because of the environmental footprint. Before COVID, I was cycling two hours a day, an hour to work, an hour back. And I've cycled all over Melbourne for different work. I've done yoga since the 80s. I'm 64 in a few months and I still do handstands and various arm balances. I windsurf competitively, I speed sail. So we go out in gale force winds and sail up around 80 kilometres an hour if we can get the right conditions. I've been hospitalised because of that, but I still love doing that. So, yeah, I have a very active life and I keep fit. Try to practice what I preach and make sure I can still keep doing these things for decades to come.
So I was just going to ask, where along the line then did you pivot from just vegetarian to a completely plant-based lifestyle, and what kind of inspired that?
Oh, that was 91 when I was living in Montreal and I read that Diet for a New America book. That set me on the path. And I moved not long after that to San Francisco, and even in 91 there were quite a few vegans there, so it was a supportive community which made it easier to bed that in. There was even a vegan restaurant there, which is still there now, called Millennium. Very gourmet, high-end, plant-based restaurant. So, yeah, so it's been 31 years fully vegan, yeah.
So follow-up question to that then, since you've been plant-based for so many years, of course the food environment has drastically changed since then. Particularly in the last, 50, 60 years or so, there's been that explosive growth in manufacturing and consumption of ultra-processed food. So I'd be really interested to know how you've seen that nutrition profile of plant-based diets kind of change over time, being in the space for so long.
Yeah, a lot of changes. There wasn't any market for vegan food 30 years ago, so we couldn't even buy soy milk when I lived in San Francisco. I guess some of the Asian stores might have had it, but I didn't think they were any close to me. But all you could get was a powdered mix, which was pretty horrible. I had restaurants and cafes look at me blankly when I said, "Have you got vegan food?" One person even asked if I was a Star Trekkie. They thought I'd mix it up with a Vulcan. Now, 30 years on, there's vegan junk food everywhere. The supermarkets are full of pre-prepared, oily, salty, refined grain meals. Cafes all have vegan food. There's vegan chocolates, ice cream, donuts, everything you could want. Every replica of vegan cheese is at a high in coconut oil, usually, and high in salt. So actually I see more and more patients in my private practice who are vegans, who are overweight and getting health problems because of launching into this very tempting vegan junk food. So it's easy to do that.
You talk about the vegan community, a few decades ago, and you've already touched on that, the whole profile has changed. I mean, I regularly sort of refer back to, if you were a vegan 20, 30 years ago, you were considered a hippie. You were a minority, vegans still these days, or plant-based still a minority, but relatively speaking, you were odd. Vegetarian, okay, vegan or plant-based. But as you say, and as Emma's mentioned, Now, it's all about consumerism, right? It's all about business. You're not a good business now if you don't offer vegan options. You'll go out of business. There's lactose intolerant. There's all sorts of other reasons why now people choose to eat that way. But, you know, I'm keen to start deep diving into a few components of that because, you know, the old adage of, but I don't know what to buy if I need to eat plant-based. It's like, well, the grocery aisle, you know, the fresh produce aisle rather. Simple, but it's not. Because now you go down every aisle and there's vegan options. It's vegan, buy me. So let's talk a little bit about those issues because you mentioned a lot of patients now you're seeing are vegan, are plant-based, but they've still got health issues. And that's important because we put such a big emphasis on give up meat and your health is better or give up this and your health is better. But actually it's not just a give this up and, but it's vegan, it's fine, it's healthy. So why those pitfalls and why, you know, why are we not fixing the problem by simply going vegan, just loosely?
It's been said, and I agree with this, that we, and it's largely true, we have a food system that doesn't care about health and a health system that doesn't care about food. And it's important to realize that food businesses, whether they're manufacturers of packaged food or cafes or restaurants, their primary goal is not your health. Their primary goal is to get you to come back and buy more of that food. And whether they realize it or not, what they're doing is manipulating the pleasure trap. So they're dialing up the salt, the fat, the sugar, trying to create that bliss point, which Michael Moss talks about so well in his work, Salt, Sugar, Fat, and his new book, Hooked. They want to make that food craveable so that you come back again. So that you remember that food as being amazing and you look forward to the next time you can buy it, even if that's the next day. But that food is not going to improve your health. And as I said, that's not their goal at all, generally, with rare exceptions. So it's seductive and we like that food and it's not anyone's fault. We're wired to seek the richest food in the environment. That's the genius of the Pleasure Trap book and the concept developed by Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Alan Goldhammer, that all animals have the same wiring. We get a dopamine hit when we gorge on rich food, and that helped us through the millennia survive, and it still helps wild animals today, whose biggest threat is hunger or starvation. But in the modern world, that's an absolute disaster because this food is cheap and omnipresent. It's everywhere we turn, even when you fill up with gas. Every cafe, every supermarket has beautifully presented, energy-concentrated, flavor-enhanced foods that are designed to be addictive. And this undoes most people. I spend quite a bit of time talking with patients about this so that reassuring them that it isn't their fault, that they're doing exactly as programmed. This is something that is just part of our wiring. And it helps people to understand that to help them survive and navigate that obesogenic world. If they know what's driving this and they can make strategies to work against it.
Okay, so let's remind our listeners, as it's always good to go over the important components. What's really palatable, what's really addictive, salt, or saltiness, sweetness, and fat. What are the issues with it? Let's start with salt. Is salt completely bad? If not, how much should we have? What should we be looking out for when it comes to salt?
We don't have a biological need to add salt to our food. Our ancestors didn't have it. Pre-agriculture, our primate cousins don't add salt to their food. We can get enough sodium through the plants we eat. So it's not needed. And extra salt added is harmful to us in a number of ways. It damages our microbiome, as you would imagine, because we use salt to preserve food. So if you add enough salt to food, it stops it getting microbial damage, fungi and bacteria, etc. But there's also a linear relationship with salt consumption and hypertension. And most middle-aged people have high blood pressure and that gets worse as they get older. And salt is contributing massively to that. So It also leads people to overeat, as do the other two components you mentioned, Ben, the sugar and the fat. So it increases the pleasurability of the food. So if you would imagine boiling some potatoes and having one without salt and then having another time some with salt, you'd eat more of the ones that are salted. It makes it more desirable. It makes us more hungry and predisposes us to overeat, as do adding sugar and fat. And we're approaching 70% of Western nations' populations are overweight or obese. The things that are making people overeat are not good to have. We don't need that. People have enough trouble keeping a healthy weight as it is. So when these foods have added salt, sugar, and fat, and particularly when they're skillfully combined, it makes that food so irresistible, and people eat more than they need through each meal and through the day and week after week. And it doesn't take long before they're packing on the kilos. And then they develop chronic diseases. So salt should be kept to an absolute minimum. And we can retrain our palate, our taste buds to not need it. And then you can find after a month or so that you have a new appreciation of the subtle and beautiful flavors of plain fruit and vegetables without these added components. So a carrot, you can taste the symphony of flavors in a carrot and enjoy that without your palate being deadened and dulled by, you know, all the salt, fat, and sugar that's dominating the flavor.
You raise a really good point there that your taste buds definitely do adjust and you do get used to what you're eating. But if we take someone that is used to these hyper palatable, ultra processed foods, and we try to sell them on eating some boiled potatoes without any salt or butter or, you know, any of these additives, that's a tough sell. So do you have any tips for people who are really trying to make that transition? Like, should they actually be transitioning in a stepwise process, or do people need to go cold turkey, or does it depend on the individual? Any tips or tricks there?
Depending on the person, either of the two you said, Emma, so stepwise reductions, or as I prefer to call it, cold tofu, depends on the personality, on their environment and who they live with. Some people are more gung-ho, and they, once they get it, they go, yep, that makes sense. I'm embracing that tomorrow or tonight. And other people go, oh, that's a bit scary. You know, I'd rather go gradually, dip my toe in. So both work. There are pros and cons. You know, if you can get people to go overnight to a super healthy eating style, they will feel the physical benefits more quickly and a sharper change. And if they're very unwell and in pain, they'll see a sharp reduction in pain. So that's very reinforcing. Whereas if it's a gradual transition, the downside is you're maintaining the taste for those processed and salty, fatty foods to some extent every time you have them, but you're not getting as much of a significant feedback that will motivate you because it's gradual, you know, like the frog in the pot of water. So it depends on what the person can do, but the main thing is they head in the right direction either way. And I'll help people with both strategies, and I run them by people, and different people will choose different ways depending on who they are. They both work. The main thing is to get to a point where you don't need those processed foods and that extra salt, fat, and sugar. And the food can taste bland initially. It's worth warning people that is a consequence for some people, but I also support people with ways to season the food to make it taste better with nutritional yeast, with lemon, chili, garlic, herbs, onion powder, garlic powder, things like that. There are many ways to make an amazing tasting plant-based meal that even a person coming straight from an omnivore diet would really enjoy, but not everybody has those cooking skills in their own home. So their first attempt, they might go, oh, that's pretty bad. You know, and, you know, then my role is to just help support them through that to either improve their cooking and also to be patient until their taste buds adjust.
I think most people could probably benefit from expanding their palate a little bit and stepping outside their usual box, using more herbs and spices and you know, vegetables they're not used to and getting a bit experimental in the kitchen.
Yeah, agreed. So sugar, again, fruit is our natural sugar source, and that should taste magnificently sweet if you bite into a fresh peach in summer or any other fruit in season that's ripe. And except if you have that after a Mars bar or any other piece of chocolate or sweet, it's not going to taste sweet. You'll be underwhelmed because your palate's been blunted by that intense refined sugar kick. So people can get more joy in natural foods as grown that are more healthy if they can wean back the sugar as well, and to a point where you wouldn't need to add it at all. And I don't even encourage people to use maple syrup or any of those other sugar syrups, because they're really fiber free and they're still highly concentrated sugars. I would rather see people using some dried sultanas or dates or something like that to sweeten things, or apple puree or ripe bananas. And I share people recipes with those, you know, for things like muffins and black bean brownie that don't require any sugar.
Your famous black bean brownies, I can vouch for them. I've got to play devil's advocate though here. So what would you say to someone who really enjoys their, I don't know, roasted Brussels sprouts with a little bit of maple syrup on them, or, you know, they might actually eat more broccoli if there's a teaspoon of oil that they're sauteed in? Like, obviously they're potentially displacing better options, but if they're actually consuming more of said vegetable or grain or fruit with a little bit of an additive, what's your opinion there? Is there any wriggle room there?
For me, I'd rather they didn't. I know some people like Dr. John McDougall say a little bit of salt on the meal when it's served is okay. He wouldn't allow oil. I try to support the people to not need those things and to help them with recipes so that they can take away that crutch, if you like, or that inducement to overeat, which I see them as problematic in that way, that they're not healthy, they're empty calories, the sugar and the oil. It increases the risk of overeating that food. I don't find if people can make a nice meal and leave out those things and learn to adjust their taste buds, then things like Brussels sprouts roasted will taste fabulous. Like this week earlier, we got a whole head of cauliflower in our veggie box and we broke it into small pieces, put it on baking paper and just baked it till it browned a little. It smelled amazing and it tasted fabulous. We devoured that whole head. It was huge. It was such a treat and it needed nothing on it at all. And it was so tasty. So I'd just rather have people learn to relearn to enjoy plant foods as grown and cooked in different ways or eaten raw in a salad. I think that's more important. And the oil, I know this is a controversial thing amongst some plant-based practitioners, but I see it as a junk food. I don't see that it has any place other than perhaps as a moisturizer. I use it on my skin occasionally, but I've done some numbers before this talk for you that a tablespoon of olive oil in Australian terms is 20 grams, I think, and that's 180 calories. Now, if you add that in, have one tablespoon per day, if you're going to have an isocaloric day and have the same amount of calories, then that would be displacing 315 grams of blueberries, 2 cups roughly, or half a kilo of broccoli is the same calories, which is about 5 to 6 cups, or about 200 grams of boiled potato, which would be 1.5 cups, or a third of a cup of cooked chickpeas, 100 grams. So which is better for you? Which would you prefer the patients to be eating? Broccoli, chickpeas, blueberries, potato, you know, more of those, or one tablespoon of oil, which is not a lot. Most people probably have more than that. And the vast majority of my patients are wanting to lose weight. So I don't want to be recommending the most energy-dense food on the planet to them that's going to make them overeat, and it's going to slow their weight loss and it's going to displace nutrients that will nourish them and make them heal and run better. And if it doesn't displace those other foods, then they're going to have too many calories. They're adding that any bit of oil they add is adding extra calories, like at 180 calories per tablespoon. So either way, it's a lose-lose in my opinion. I'm not so worried about the science of whether it's causes flow-mediated dilation in the arm or damages the endothelial cells. That stuff's, you know, been argued back and forth. I see the practicalities in the clinical setting, and it doesn't help. And I think that's the most important thing. In the end, I want to get the patient healthy. I want to help them on their journey and achieve their goals. And I don't see a place for oil in that. And it kind of interests me that people cling to oil so much. There's a weird psychological process at play, because people don't have this kind of argument about white sugar, which everybody would argue is a would agree is a junk food. But somehow we have these debates about oil, and people get really upset. Don't take away my oil. I even saw this in workplace health programs when we enrolled people. They knew it was plant based, but at the first briefing, we told them it was also no oil. And they were more freaked out about no oil than they were about having no animal food for 3 weeks. That really interested me. And there's something unusual, and I haven't put my finger on what it is, but there's something weird at play that people cling to this food. And it might be just that it's the most energy-dense food on the planet, and it's the pleasure trap. You know, even if we know better, people are still looking for a way to slip a little bit into their meal. And there's also the problem if you give people a slice, they take the loaf. You know, if you say a little bit's okay, then they're going glug, glug, glug here, glug, glug, glug here. And before you know it, it might be half a cup of a day. And they're not losing any weight. And, you know, I don't think that's responsible. If that person's had a heart attack or they have type 2 diabetes and they're coming to me to get well, this is going to slow their healing. I think it's my duty to say, leave this out. This is the most energy dense food. It's completely free of fiber, minerals, phytonutrients, a tiny bit of polyphenol, tiny bit of vitamin E, but you can get far more of those in whole plant foods. I just don't see a place for it.
It's the topic of oil is controversial, because as you've already touched on, and there's a lot of papers and research. We understand some studies are not quite, you know, done the correct way, perhaps. So that's up for debate as well. We know it's entrenched in some societies, like people refer to the Mediterranean diet, which people falsely think, Mediterranean diet's all about olive oil. No, it's not. It just happens to have it, but it's not all about. But it seems to be entrenched. You know, the Romans used to press olives, and so it's been around for so long. So it's been part of cuisines for so long, but not just oil. I mean, in other cultures, it's other forms of fat as well. Now, you've mentioned this earlier, you know, even a century ago, a caloric dense food was a good thing because that might have been your only meal for the day, or a caloric dense food might have been as part of a feast. So once every 6 months, so it was okay. But it is something that's so entrenched. And yet we also find it's always creeping in somewhere. So we know ultra processed foods, it contains the big three, the salt, the sugar, the oil. Yes, we know that's bad. But it creeps in areas like plant-based milks, the pre-mixed. I do use soy milk, but I buy the powder. So it's just 100% soy. So I avoid that problem. But for most, where then they are recommended to, if you need to get certain minerals or vitamins, like boost your calcium or your vitamin D or something, buy a plant-based milk that's perhaps been enhanced or fortified, but it's got the oils in there. So it is controversial. And Emma's also touched on the point that when trying to convert someone, that palatability, you know, you could lose someone because it's awful, they're gone, or you ease them into it. Is there such a thing of weaning off the oil? Is it based on relativity? Someone weighs a tremendous amount, and while they're cutting back, well, the oil is relative to everything else they've been consuming. Is there a middle ground? Can there be? I mean, there's opinions and there's what we should be doing, perhaps from a health reason. Someone's had a heart cardiac arrest. Yes, you need to go all in. But can there be a middle ground that, you know, okay, it's not bad. It's not the end of the world. Or in your opinion, if we're doing something, let's do it well.
Yeah, if I have a patient with who's had a heart attack or has type 2 diabetes or, say, rheumatoid arthritis, I will say, if you want to get well, you have to aim for zero. If they're just an ordinary person without any serious conditions, I'll say minimize or avoid oil in my follow-up email. But I'll try to explain when they're with me why zero is best, but I don't expect everyone will get to that. So I'll say minimize or avoid. But something I didn't say earlier, there are studies showing where oil purportedly showing it's healthy, like mental block. But there are no studies that I know of that show that a whole food plant-based diet with oil is better than a whole food plant-based diet without. And until we see that study, and I seriously doubt if it was done, it would show benefit through adding that oil. And then unless that's demonstrated, I still don't see any reason to use it. And even then, I find it hard that any study could show that, because you're adding empty calories to displace full nutrient complete whole foods. And it just, how could that be a good thing? So no, in answer to your question, I'm not rigid with people. I'd rather they go on the journey and start making progress. But I do try to equip them with the knowledge that the less the better, all the way down to zero of oil is going to be the most help. But I understand we live in a real world and people have family and they have work food and they have lunches out and, you know, they have their palate. They don't want the food to be too dull. I've got a recent example of a patient who was morbidly obese. And I gave her my lasagna recipe, which is a couple of hours to make. I make it on a weekend, and it makes two big trays. And it has no oil, no sugar, no salt. And she made that, and she said her and her family and her husband just raved about it. And her husband takes it to work, and he said all his colleagues are asking what he's got and wanting some when he's heating it up because it smells so amazing. And not a skerrick of oil. And Ed, it's food that's absolutely delicious. And I've served it to many people. And they go, this is amazing. And it's not hard to make. You know, it with all those flavors and spices and seasonings and herbs and stuff, you don't even know it's there. It's not there. It's not something you'd miss. So, yeah, I know people live in the real world, so I try to work with people where they're at and help them. And the same with animal food. I say, look, the less you have down to zero, the better, but I don't expect everyone will all switch to zero, and I'll support them however much they want to do.
I just want to circle back on one thing quickly when we're talking about sugars, because this is quite topical and this is a conversation I seem to have a lot with people. Sugar is a very generic term. Now, the conversation we've had here about sugar is refined sugar, so generally cane sugar. But people misinterpret that as, I need to avoid sugars, I need to avoid fruit. My health protection or my nutritionist or my coach or my whatever told me I need to cut out fruit because I need to cut out sugar. Now, that's a problem, isn't it?
Big problem. And I'm very clear to people about the difference. And I tell people to eat as much fruit as they like. Like I would probably have 10 serves a day, easy. And I explain that to every patient. You know, fruit is fabulous. And any sugars are in situ, the way we're designed to take them with the fiber, with the water, we get a slower release. It has all the good things coming with it. But refined sugars, no. Get down to zero if you can. There's no need for them, no place for them. They're not healthful. It's a pretty simple conversation, really. But people come in with all kinds of misconceptions and things they've been told or things they've read or things that diabetes educators have told them, which are frequently wrong.
Or doctors.
or doctors, yeah, many of whom are low carbers. So
yeah,
it's, It's a minefield out there in nutrition.
Well, on that low carb point and the paleo point and the keto point and the Atkins and the South Beach and should I go on? When we're talking, we've had the conversation on oil, but actually fat and saturated fats. Should the, you know, effectively your recommendations you've been giving to us on oils, should that extend to saturated fats as well? So we're also talking about plant foods in some instances, some plant foods.
Like your coconut products.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most of the saturated fats are gone if people are not eating animal food. So that solves that one. But I discourage people from having coconut, unless it's a teaspoon or two here and there of desiccated, you know, or fresh coconut with the water and the fiber. But not coconut cream, not coconut milk, not coconut yogurt. I'm constantly talking to people. I look at their food diaries they send me and say, that coconut yogurt's not going to help you. It's too much saturated fat. It'll give you heart disease. I show people how to make their own soy yogurt, which I make. And I use the soy milk that doesn't have oil. I send, referring to your comment earlier, I send people a photo of the three common types of plant milk, all soy, which don't have oil, and encourage people to use those. And I do recommend soy ahead of almond and oat, because soy is protective against some cancers. And I think that's an edge that it's good to help people with.
And we did have to mention, though, that you're not just teaching people this in your private practice setting either. You're also co-founder and a facilitator with Melbourne Lifestyle Medicine, and you're very soon going to be holding a retreat. I think by the time this goes to air, they'll be 1 week away. So tell us a little bit about your offerings there and what people can expect if they get involved with Melbourne Lifestyle Medicine.
Yeah, thanks, Emma. And those are so much fun to do. Like I could, they're tiring because we're up early and we're busy all day, but they're just such a joy to do. And the difference with private practice is that in private practice, you're giving people the why and the how, but the third leg that helps people is the peer support. And I try to link people into things like Facebook groups and the plant-powered meetup potluck meals in Melbourne, but it's not the same as having a cohort that you go through with for a week and get to know. And then we have, you know, and regular follow-up alumni meetings. So the retreats, we have a fabulous place in the Yarra Valley that we use, set on 40 hectares with kangaroos and koalas, even a bowerbird there and a river running through. It's so pretty. We're doing a 7-day program there. And we teach people a lot about nutrition, including cooking classes. We have a team of us delivering the program. So Malcolm and Jenny mentioned earlier, and myself as the three main partners. My partner is a trauma therapist. So she comes and does a mental health self-care day or session, which is fabulous. We have a fitness instructor, personal instructor, who does fitness for seniors, because a lot of our people are a little older, not all, but he's people love him. He's so energetic and he's in his early 70s and he's a dynamo. So that's Graham Ellis, who's fabulous to work with. And we have a fully qualified vegan chef, Julia Gruskin, who does the food for us with some help from the center staff. And so yeah, it's a full-on program. We have a 100-page manual and recipe book that we give people. There we give them individual medical and dietetic consults, and we can do that in an office or on a walk through the beautiful estate, you know, while we walk and talk. So they're a lot of fun. And we have yoga in the mornings, we have meditation every afternoon, or we have a walk or a run or a fitness class. So it's covering all the domains of lifestyle medicine, because Malcolm and I are both qualified in lifestyle medicine. And so we're helping people with all those upstream determinants of well-being to either keep them well or help them recover from whatever illnesses they have, or losing weight And we get fabulous feedback. People just rave about it. And many people have come more than once because they enjoy it so much.
And it's also a really great opportunity for, you know, like med students or dietetic students to learn more about the benefits of lifestyle medicine and plant-based nutrition as well. You take on volunteers. So tell us about that for anyone that's interested.
Yes, well, each retreat we have space for a volunteer, and we give them accommodation, and in return for helping out with some of the prep in the kitchen and so on, they get to sit in on all the classes pretty much and participate in all the activities. So we're expressly inviting new graduate dietitians or med students. We've even had a GP come along and help at an early retreat. So it's about helping train up and expose the next generation of practitioners to the power of this sort of thing, and getting them across all the science so that we have more practitioners out there who are skilled in this area and can help with the change that we need. Because I'm also with Doctors for Nutrition, as you are, Emma, and a key goal of Doctors for Nutrition is to change the healthcare system so that we are educating doctors and other health practitioners around the power of plant-based nutrition.
And this probably brings us to another topic that you're very passionate about and you've presented on a number of times, including for Doctors for Nutrition. So we've talked about the health benefits associated with this way of eating, but the environmental benefits as well. I know we've covered this a lot on the podcast, but for anyone that's, you know, a new listener and new to plant-based eating, what we choose to put on our plate, it really matters quite a bit in terms of the ecological footprint, doesn't it?
Enormous. In fact, it's argued that it's the single biggest thing anyone can do to reduce their footprint. It's so powerful. I've taught master's level students on this subject with an all-day class, and hope to do more of that. I've given talks on this. I'm currently in the process of trying to book with local environment groups to talk on this, because many of them don't have this on their radar. They're looking at other things like solar panels and wind farms, and food is kind of the elephant in the room. And it's actually the biggest and easiest thing that anyone can do to dramatically lower their footprint. It's also many faceted and quite complicated. Like, it's linked to biodiversity loss. It's linked to groundwater shortages and lakes drying out, zoonotic diseases, antibiotic resistance, topsoil loss, deforestation. It's enormously inefficient and wasteful. The way we produce food currently is going to lead to famine in future, because we cannot feed the world's population with the way we currently produce food. Even today, we have 800 million people who go hungry every day. So the food system is broken. We're also creating ocean dead zones. Fisheries are overfished and many are in collapse. And compounding that is the global warming, which is steadily limiting our capacity to produce, shrinking our harvests each year. So these are all diabolical problems, and they're interrelated, and they're bearing down upon our food system. So yeah, so the changes, like, since the dawn of farming 10,000 years ago, of all the mammal biomass, 99% was wild mammals and humans were 1%. By 2015, that had gone to wild animals were 4%, humans are 36%, and livestock is 60% of all the biomass of mammals. And the same for birds. 70% of all birds on the planet now are poultry for our food. Well, not my food, but for other people's food. But 30% of the remaining birds on the planet are wild. And we're in the beginning of the sixth mass extinction. This is escalating. Humans have just had such a devastating effect on the ecosystem. One study showed that humans are 0.1% of all life on Earth, And since the beginning of agriculture 10,000 years ago, we've destroyed 83% of wild mammals. It's a quarter of all species are threatened with risk of extinction. One study published this year showed that land clearing alone in Queensland was 90,000 hectares of koala habitat. Now, this is just, and insects, many people don't realize this. It's predicted that insects could vanish within a century at the current rate of decline. They're declining at a rate of about 2.5% per year. Now, that might sound small, but that's 25%. That's a quarter every decade. And they've already declined enormously in the last few decades. So, and this is because of pesticide use, intensive agriculture, land clearing, getting rid of shrubs and things that normally surround fields, and climate change. Jonas Salk, who was a virologist who developed the polio vaccine, famously said that if all the insects were to disappear from the earth, within 50 years, all life on earth would end. Whereas if all human beings disappeared from the earth, within 50 years, all forms of life would flourish. And that's a powerful quote. You know, and the insect population decline means we're losing the small animals that eat the insects, the birds, the lizards, etc.
Pollination.
Pollination, exactly, Ben. Frankly, it terrifies me. I'm not certain that as a species we'll make it. And many of the analysts who are looking at this closely think the same. The oceans are in decline. There are huge dead zones because of deoxygenization from the sea warming. It can carry less oxygen. Algal blooms kill the fish, and they're caused by effluent runoff and fertilizer runoff. The meat industry is the key driver of this. It's the effluent from the animal industry flowing out rivers uncontained that's leading to these ocean dead zones. Another report said we lost 11 million hectares of tree cover last year around the world. And this is despite pledges at COP26 to reduce land clearing. The Amazon is thought to be in the balance where it might get to a tipping point where it's too dry and too warm and it burns or it just can't recover because they're meant to be rainforests. It's meant to be wet. You know, we saw rainforests in Australia burn in 2019 that have never burned before in a million years because they're not designed to burn like other Australian forests. So if the Amazon goes up in flames and the Brazilian government and Bolsonaro are encouraging land burning and clearing. So the Amazon has been called the lungs of the earth and has so much biodiversity that we haven't even described yet. This is an incalculably priceless asset, which is in the balance and might be gone in the rest of our lifetimes. So the ethics of this is really disturbing because we're essentially stealing the future from our children and our grandchildren. With the slaughterhouses, we're creating trauma and violence to the people we pay to kill animals for our food. The research shows that these slaughterhouse workers have increased domestic violence and other health problems. We're slaughtering 80 billion land animals a year for food for just 8 billion humans and up to 2.5 trillion sea animals we're fishing out every year. This is deeply unethical and not sustainable. We've just come through COVID. The experts have been predicting pandemics. When I was doing my PhD at ANU, the world leader in influenza research, Professor Graham Laver, was in the building working there. And I remember him saying back then in the late 80s that we were overdue for another influenza pandemic, which will make AIDS look like a picnic. Now, the intensive agriculture is like a petri dish to breed virulent new strains, and they're emerging at increasing pace through year after year. And it's only a matter of time until one is released and spreads, which is both highly lethal and highly contagious. You know, we got lucky with COVID in a way. It was a dress rehearsal because it had a mortality rate of, you know, less than 0.5%. If that was 5 or 10 or 20%, we would have seen huge swathes of humanity wiped out. In a way, it was a lucky break and let us sharpen up our systems. We know that many of our infectious diseases, about 75%, have begun since the beginning of the domestication of animals around 10,000 years ago. So we got measles from cows and sheep, and that's killed 200 million people, smallpox from camels, whooping cough from pigs, etc. You know, this is a natural proximity to these animals, which would be wild, that increases the probability of transmission of disease from them. And now with land clearing and logging into native forests, we're getting new viruses that are coming into contact with us. You know, that's where HIV came from, Ebola, SARS, West Nile virus. You know, who knows what else is down the track. Antibiotic resistance is growing. And in the US, 23,000 people a year now die from antibiotic resistance. And many people don't realize, but this precious arsenal of antibiotics, which is so hard to develop, 80% of all antibiotics in the US are being fed to livestock, and similar in other developing countries, purely for prophylactically preventing disease, but also they help promote growth. But this means we're exposing the bacteria and fast-tracking the development of antibiotic-resistant microbes. So we're quite rapidly approaching a post-antibiotic era. So that means if you get an infection in your knee or something, there may be no option but to amputate above the knee, as they had to in past times before penicillin. This is not a very smart use of antibiotics. Many people might know about the study in Science magazine 3 years ago from Poor and Nemesik. It was hugely praised as a massively comprehensive study. It covered 40,000 farms in most of the countries of the world and 90% of all the world food production. It was very, very in depth. They found that this is relating to the inefficiency of raising animals for food. 83% of the world's agricultural land produces only 18% of the calories that we eat. That is terribly, terribly wasteful. And yet that same animal agriculture produces 60% of all agricultural greenhouse gases. They also found that if hypothetically the whole world went vegan, we could cut agricultural land use by 76% and restore that land to wilderness. And at the same time, we would halve greenhouse gases. So this is incredibly powerful. And this study was bottom up, and it neatly dovetailed with previous research that was top down. So very, very highly regarded, comprehensive research, which really should send alarm bells around the world. We still have, as I said earlier, 800 million people roughly starve to death or go hungry around the world. And yet about half the world's grain is fed directly to livestock. In the US, it's about 70% of all the grain they grow. This is incredibly inefficient. And yet while we're feeding that precious grain to livestock, getting, you know, 10 kilos in, 1 kilo of meat back, 15,000 children under 5 are starving to death every day of the year, 15,000 kids around the world. And this is from the World Health Organization. Those people could be fed with the grain that's going to that livestock. The other thing that's bearing down upon us is food security. People know about peak oil, but we also have peak water, peak land, peak phosphorus, peak fish. We have diminishing investment in research and development to improve agricultural productivity. And on top of that, global warming is reducing the yield year on year as the globe gets hotter and drier and more storms and floods. And yet at the same time, we've got a million new mouths to feed, new kids born every 3 days. So the population is still growing and they're living longer lives, so they'll be needing more food. The developing countries' consumption and appetite for meat is going up rapidly. As such, it's expected we'll need to double the food supply globally by 2060, with all those constraints of, as I mentioned, peak water, peak land, peak oil. We're losing topsoil, 75 to 100 gigatons a year, because every crop of monoculture, it blows away, it washes into the rivers. Some estimates are that in around 50 years, we won't have any topsoil left, and we've only got about 50 years more of crops. The soil is a thin layer around the globe, which is the basis for all terrestrial life. We need that soil to keep living, and we're losing it at such a rate. We're looking at the risk of progressive breakdown of capacity due to the excessive demographic pressure and agricultural practices. Cities are expanding onto the best peri-urban land, which is the most fertile often. Desertification is increasing and shrinking the area of global farmland. And also the peak oil, as I mentioned. So we're expected to have fast declining reserves of oil to fuel the agriculture. Agriculture is highly oil dependent. So, yeah, there's a whole series of diabolical problems. One study said that, and the importance of the food system is that this study looked at this and said, even if we eliminated all of fossil fuel emissions immediately, without changes to the global food system, it would be impossible to limit warming to 1.5 degrees and possibly even to 2 degrees. So hypothetically, if we could get rid of all fossil fuel tomorrow, it won't be enough without major changes to the food system. So we have no choice but to change the food system. I think I've blathered on for enough.
Well, you have brought so much passion to this conversation, Peter. So don't apologize. We're appreciative of that. But you know, we've said this often. There's no point in being the healthiest, the youngest looking, fittest person on the planet if there's no planet to stand on. And what you've just highlighted now is crucial. It's the food on our plate, as Emma started off with, is crucial. It's not just what we eat for ourselves, it's part of the food system that we've created that's causing a lot of these issues. Would we have always had it? Maybe, up for debate, but we've certainly accelerated the issue quite dramatically. And as such, we're suffering a lot of losses, issues, and so on in terms of everything you've mentioned. And that list is long. And that's how urgent the state that we're in, the state of emergency, as we should call it, not national. It's a global state of emergency that we're in. But look, we really, really want to thank you. One thing we do need to mention is Perfect Human Food. That's your practice. We didn't really give you a chance to talk about that. But the one thing I do like about it is, yes, your focus is on nutrition, but you incorporate lifestyle medicine components. So it's a very holistic approach. And that's something we talk a lot about on the show as well. It's not just one thing. It's everything we do around it. And we will, for our listeners, have links to all these platforms and so on in our show notes. So they'll be able to go onto the website, look up the retreat, if not this one, because it might be a bit short notice, but look, subscribe and find out about the upcoming retreats. I absolutely love what you guys do at the retreat in terms of mentoring new students or graduates and so on. I think that's a wonderful thing you do. Because it's not just what we do know, a lot of us learn at uni, and it, unfortunately, it's not as practical as it should be. But that's a wonderful way to upskill oneself the way we should. So I'll stop blabbering, but I'll wrap it up. Thank you so much for your knowledge. You are a very big, as we call it, a big player in the plant-based community. You're a leader in that space. And we're only grateful for people like yourself that bring so much passion and knowledge to this field. So thank you for coming onto the show, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely to talk with you both.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.